I know this is an old cliche, but it's ever true. The ball game is never over until the final out, especially an all-star game. And how well I remember this one. Detroit, Briggs Stadium, 1941. And the 55,000 fans were ready for a show. Little realizing that a year from that date, many of the men on the field would be wearing another kind of uniform. This day, they came to see DiMaggio, Greenberg, and someone named Bob Feller. And a new sports sensation, just a kid named Ted Williams. Ted Williams had joined the American League in Boston 2 years before, and he had pitchers still trying to find a formula for getting him out. Because as this all-star game approached, he was holding a fabulous .405 batting mark. Now, naturally, this didn't make the National League starter feel too secure. I opened the pitching for the American League, successfully cutting them down by pitching to 9 men the first 3 innings. The National League took care of us in a similar fashion. Cincinnati's Paul Derringer gave up a run in the 4th, and Ted Williams sent another American League tally across with a double in the 6th. Meanwhile, Archie Vaughn of the Pittsburgh Pirates held the hottest National League bat and slammed a pair of home runs. So the American League came to bat in the bottom of the 8th. They were trailing in the All-Star game by a score of 5-2. Edgar Smith held the National League scoreless in the top of the 9th. Paso retired to first American leaguer at the bottom of the 9th. But Cleveland's Ken Keltner, in a pinch hit role, singled off shortstop Eddie Miller's glove. Cecil Travis of Washington was next, and he walked, sending Keltner to second and bringing up DiMaggio to the plate. By now, the fans were starting for the exits, while at the same time, almost en masse, they were yelling for Joe to hit a home run. Instead, he sent a grass cutter at Miller, which had double play written all over it. Miller scooped the ball up, fired to second to force Travis. DiMaggio, however, was safe at first. There were 2 outs. 2 runners on base. The score, National League 5, American League 4. Next batter up, the kid, Ted Williams. We'll finish the game in 60 seconds. Ted went through his little ritual, which has now become so familiar. His left foot scuffed a little dirt. Then he bounced on the balls of both feet. He squeezed his bat as he waited for the first pitch from Paso. Foul, strike 1. 2 more pitches were wide, and Ted wanted no part of them. Paso fired again, and this time Ted swung. The bat cracked, and the ball sailed far and high into the right field seats. Keltner, DiMaggio, and of course the kid Ted Williams scored. The American League had won, 7-5. And that Williams homer that day was but a prelude to many, many more he was to hit to break up a game before he retired. I'm a football fan, and every football fan has memories of the greatest game he ever saw, and I'm no exception. How well I remember a cold December afternoon in 1958. A couple of professional football teams struggled for the National Football League Championship. Some say it was the greatest game ever played. Maybe it was. If it wasn't, we'll have to do until a better one comes along. Let's go back to Yankee Stadium to relive the struggle of struggles. 65,185 fans roared as the Giants took a 3-0 lead in the opening quarter on a 36-yard field goal by Pat Summerall. But 3 points wouldn't hold up against the Colts. The fans knew it, and so did the Giants. One could almost feel the tension on the field and in the stands. Then the Colts broke the scoring ice and pitched over a pair of touchdowns in the second stanza to walk off the field with a 14-3 halftime advantage. As the third period got underway, the Giants found themselves with their backs to the wall. The Colts were on the 1-yard line. But Colt fullback Alan Amici was dropped for a loss, and the Giants took possession on their own 5. 5 plays, 95 yards later, and the Giants were back in the game. Fullback Mel Triplett lunged over from the 1 to climax the drive. In Kyle Rote had hauled in a pass from Charlie Connery. Fumbled it, the ball was picked up by teammate Alex Webster, and he was finally brought down on the 1. Triplett then went over. On a second play of the final quarter, Connery connected to Gifford, who raced 16 yards down the sidelines for a touchdown. The stadium rocked with cheers as the scoreboard showed the Giants ahead 17-14. Burt Reischauer attempted to even the score with a field goal, but the 46-yard try was short and wide. With only 2 minutes and 25 seconds left, the Giants missed by inches on a first down and had to punt. Baltimore took over on its own 16. The Colts were 84 yards away from victory, but time was running out. Johnny Unitas missed on a pass, then another. Finally, he connected to Lenny Moore, then Ray Berry. The tide had turned for the Colts. In seconds, they were on the Giants 16. No time for a huddle. In rushed George Shaw and Steve Myra. Shaw to hold. Myra to try for the field goal. The clock showed only 7 seconds left. The ball was placed on the 20. I'll be back in 60. The snap from center, the kick, good. The gun sounded. The bitterly fought contest had ended in a 17-17 tie, forcing the first sudden death playoff in league history. But there's a sequel to this saga. The Giants won the toss, but couldn't get a drive started. Baltimore took over and in 12 plays marched 80 yards. Amici went the final yard, slicing off tackle for the clincher. The Colts were the 1958 National Football League champions, tying the struggle in the final 7 seconds and winning in overtime. Bob Feller Show, program number 4. The turnstiles clicked a merry tune at Milwaukee's County Stadium on an August evening in 1961. The standing room only throng of 40,775 was the biggest stadium crowd in 2 years. Reserve seats had been sold out for weeks, and the fans lined up hours before the game at the bleacher entrances. The Braves were far off the National League pennant base, and their rivals, the Chicago Cubs, were deep in the second division. But that didn't matter. Fans came from the city, the suburbs, Chicago, and even further. They came to see a pitcher bid for a victory that would put him in a charmed circle. Lefty Jack Curtis was a Cubs starter. He was only 3 years old when his pitching rival started his pro baseball career. But that didn't make the Milwaukee pitcher's job any easier. For 4 innings, the 2 southpaws racked up zeros on the scoreboard. The Braves pushed 1 run across in the 5th, and the Cubs matched that tally in the 6th. In the 8th inning, County Stadium came alive, and Gino Cimoli walloped a home run to give the Braves the lead. A hush fell over the crowd as the pitcher walked to the mound to start the 9th inning. He was only 3 outs away from victory. Andre Rogers was the first batter, and he was erased on 4 pitches. Only 2 outs to go. Jerry Kendall was the next, and he lashed a low liner to center. But Gino Cimoli raced in and made a great sliding catch for the second out. Ernie Banks was in the bat rack for the Cubs. He had been benched for a couple of days, but was sent up as a pinch hitter. Banks grounded one hard to third, but a bad throw by Eddie Matthews gave Ernie a life. Another pinch hitter, Jim McEnany, stepped to the plate. He looked at a couple of balls and then sent a fly to right field. Hank Aaron moved over a couple of steps and pulled it in. I'll finish the story in 60 seconds. The game was over, and the pitcher, Warren Spahn, had reached a milestone in his long and meritorious career. Only a dozen pitchers before him had won as many as 300 games. Now, Spahn joined the select group of pitching greats, which include Cy Young, Christy Mathewson, Walter Johnson, Eddie Plank, and Lefty Grove. But Spahn admitted later that it was the toughest game, even though not the most important game, he had ever pitched. Bob Feller Show, program number 5. It was the final game of the 1957 season, but in a way, it was the end of an era. Many months before, New York baseball fans were shocked by the news that their beloved Giants and their arch-rival Brooklyn Dodgers were moving to greener pastures on the West Coast. But many of the die-hard fans clung to the hope that it wasn't so. Only 11,606 diehards turned out for the Giants' farewell at the Polo Grounds. And somehow their feelings were summed up in a sign in the left field bleachers. It read, "Stay, team, stay." But the team didn't stay, and a year later, the Giants and Dodgers were calling San Francisco and Los Angeles their homes. In the final game in the Polo Grounds, the Giants bowed to the Pittsburgh Pirates 9-1. But the real action came after the final out. The fans swarmed onto the field, dug up home plate, and carted away. Others took big chunks out of the outfield, and still others sawed off grandstand seats to take home as souvenirs. If Giants owner Horace Stoneham had made an appearance, they would have hauled him away, too. Some chased the players across the field and into the clubhouse. Others waited nearby and hollered for one last look at Willie Mays. Mays admitted that he was so nervous when he came to bat in the 9th inning that his hands were shaking. Willie said, "It never happened to me before. Not even in the World Series or in the All-Star games. One of the Giants' all-time pitching greats, Carl Hubbell, summed it up most eloquently when he said, "It doesn't matter where we go, this place, this stadium, will always be home to me." But the Giants did return to the Polo Grounds in New York in 1962, and I'll tell you those circumstances in just 60 seconds. Yes, the Giants returned to the Polo Grounds in 1962, but this time they were the visiting team, and the fans jammed the historic old Polo Grounds for the first series with the newly formed New York Mets to get a glimpse at their old heroes. Casey Stengel was at the Mets' helm, but it wasn't the same. 5 years is a long time to be away from home, and now a new generation of fans were cheering, and they weren't cheering the Giants. Bob Feller Show, program number 6, the Boston Marathon. Track and field is a rugged sport. A runner, a high jumper, or a pole vaulter must be in peak condition and is timing perfect for this event. But there is a sport in the running field that rates as the most rugged, the marathon. Back in 1946, the Boston Marathon celebrated its 50th anniversary. It was a gala event each year and attracted runners from all over the globe. This particular year, a young Greek runner was in the field. He had about as good a chance as anyone else, according to the expert. Stanlios Kariakides was here on a mission. The 33-year-old distant runner was in the United States to obtain aid for Greece. What better way than to run in the Boston Marathon and bring attention to his nation's problems? 10 years before, at the Olympic Games in Berlin, he had finished 7th. A handful of unknowns moved quickly to the front as the long, grueling event began over the rugged Massachusetts roads. Favorite Gerald Coate was among the leaders at the halfway mark, but he suffered a severe stomach cramp and fell by the wayside. Kariakides started to make his move and slowly passed one tiring runner after another. A Massachusetts school teacher, Johnny Kelly, had the lead as the Greek runner became a challenger, but Kelly wasn't ready to give up the front position to anyone. As the 2 leaders passed the 28-mile marker, they were head-and-head. Kelly and Kariakides both had easy strides, and they appeared that they could go on running forever. Kelly had an advantage as the race entered the final 6 miles. He knew the course, and he had won the grueling event the year before. But this was another year, another challenge, and he was certainly getting just that from the 33-year-old Greek. As Kelly and Kariakides passed the 25-mile marker, they were still side-by-side. Will the 2 runners go to the finish head-and-head? Or would another runner overtake the 2 leaders in the final mile? I'll be back in 60 seconds. The 2 runners were side by side as the rugged event moved into the final mile. This was it. Thoughts flashed through the young Greek's mind. He had to win this one. It would mean so much to so many others. Then, with only 1,000 yards left, Kelly began to tire. His legs were giving out on him. His rival pulled ahead. 1 yard, then 2. The Greek was opening daylight. Kariakides was hurting too. His legs ached. In fact, every muscle in his body hurt. But he had to keep going. At the finish, the Greek was far ahead of the American rival. Kariakides had won the race, but it was more than just a race to him. He was a man running for his country. Bob Feller Show, program number 7. One of the most stirring sports events of the year is an annual Memorial Day 500 Classic at the Indianapolis Speedway. Drivers take their lives in their hands when they roar off on the brick oval. Each year, accidents mar the event, and often death pokes his hand into the race. The 1956 race will always be remembered because of its crashes. Shortly after the start, driver Paul Russo was rolling along in the lead when suddenly his car went out of control, did a dizzy spin, and crashed into the outer wall. A few minutes later, Jimmy DeWalt from Indianapolis smashed into the outside wall on the southeast turn. Jimmy was dragged unconscious from his car. Dick Rasmussen suffered a neck injury as his car slammed into the southwest wall. And so it went, one crash after another. No sooner had the wreckage from one crack-up been cleared away than another would occur. Fans wondered whether one of the smashes would be fatal. Pat Flaherty, a driver from Chicago, trailed the field over the first 200 miles of the grueling race. Finally, he decided it was time to make his move. Pat, A 30-year-old likable redhead had won the pole position for his top time in the qualifying round. But Flaherty knew he had a long grind ahead of him, a long, dangerous road. A few minutes after Pat had moved into the lead, the caution flag was up again. This time, a four-car crack-up. One of the drivers involved, Californian Sam Hanks. He walked away from the mishap unharmed. And in a matter of minutes, Hanks was pushing Flaherty and the other leaders for their front position. Again, a hush fell over the thousands of fans as veteran driver Tony Bettenhausen smashed into the south retaining wall. He suffered a broken collarbone. Only 150 miles were left when Al Herman glanced off the inside wall. Hanks is now back in contention as the remaining drivers in the field roared into the final 50 miles. The stretch. I'll be back in 60 seconds with the finish. Hanks is right behind Flaherty and Red knew it. He kept his fingers crossed. No tire changes, no blowouts, no gas stops. He knew he couldn't afford another stop if he wanted to win. And he wanted to win badly. He had never picked up the top prize money before. Only 20 miles to go. Then 10. Then 5. Flaherty still had the lead. But Hanks was closing in rapidly behind him. Flaherty roared across the finish line ahead of Hanks. Only 22 seconds had separated the drivers. But for an accident, on a day of accidents, Hanks would have probably won the 1956 Memorial Day Classic at the Indianapolis Speedway. Bob Feller Show, program number 8. It all started with a peach basket in a YMCA gym. Now, millions of youngsters play basketball from coast to coast. In the back of their minds, there is usually one thought, to have one big night, to score a lot of points. Let's go back a few years to Philadelphia, where a very tall basketball player was rewriting the record books at Overbrook High School. College after college sought the very effective young point maker. He chose Kansas University. But even before he departed for college, the pros had an eye on him. They knew he was going to be great, one of the greatest ever. In his sophomore year, he led Kansas to the conference title, but he wasn't happy in school and quit before his class graduated. Abe Saperstein signed him, and he traveled with the famed Harlem Globetrotters. When he joined the Philadelphia Warriors for the start of the 1959-60 season, in no time he was rewriting the pro records. His scoring feats were fabulous, and his rebounding sensational. He was a smart basketball player, and he went about his job in a cool, methodical way. On March 22, 1962, the Warriors were playing the New York Knicks at Hershey, Pennsylvania, and it wasn't long before the fans got that feeling that this was going to be a special night. Philadelphia moved quickly to a 19-3 lead. The big guy had scored a dozen of those points. He wasn't much of a foul shooter, but this night, he stepped to the line 7 times, and 7 times he connected. As a buzzer ended the first quarter, a big guy had 23 points, but was far from over. In the second period, he tapped it in, hooked it in, chipped it in, and looped in his favorite fadeaway shot. At the half, the big guy had 44 points. The Warriors, especially the big guy, were cheered as they returned to the court. He couldn't miss. One basket after another went in. The fans welcomed the third quarter buzzer to catch their breath. The Warriors were ahead 125-106, and the big guy had scored 66 points. With one quarter to go, he needed 12 points to tie his own single-game record. He needed 34 to hit the century mark. Could he make it and do the impossible? In 60 seconds, we're back to find out. 8 minutes were left when he hit the 79-point mark, a new league record. Now the crowd was screaming for the big guy to score again and again. With 1:19 showing on the clock, he intercepted a pass, dribbled, and shot. The ball rimmed the basket and fell out. The crowd groaned. But he had another chance. He scored. Then another basket. The clock showed 46 seconds when the big guy took the ball with both hands, pushed it into the net. He had scored 100 points, and the crowd went wild. The big guy, who is he? It was Wilt Chamberlain, the NBA's greatest superstar. Bob Feller Show, program number 9. There was a time when pro football was a struggling sport. In the mid-20s, fans were reluctant to part with their money to see a pro football game. It was that way in Chicago and all the other cities where National Football League teams played, and even in New York. But on a Sunday afternoon in 1925, the owners of the New York Giants wore great big smiles. Tickets for the coming game against the Chicago Bears were selling faster than they could be printed. The reason? Red greens. The immortal galloping ghost had set the nation talking about his grid exploits at the University of Illinois. Every school child knew who Red Grange was. Now he was a pro football star with the Bears. More than 70,000 fans jammed the Polo Grounds for the Giants-Bears clash, and thousands of others were turned away. There was a chill in the air as Grange and his teammates crowded out on the field. An occasional boo, but mostly cheers greeted the Bears. Grange still wore that famous number 77, the number that had become a legend in college football. A roar rocked the Polo Grounds as the Giants appeared on the field. A flip of a coin, and the game was on. The fans had turned out for one reason. They wanted to see Grange. So naturally, they were disappointed when Grange didn't have a hand in the first touchdown. The Bears marched slowly down the field and towards the Giants' goal line. But it was Joe Sterman who lugged the pigskin across for the score, not Grange. He had carried the ball only 9 yards in the drive. Grange was a marked man. When the Bears went to the air, there were not two, but three defenders covering Grange. But Grange brought the crowd to its feet when he leaped high to grab a pass with defenders all around him. The play gained 25 yards and set up another Bear touchdown. But like the first touchdown, it wasn't Red who carried the ball into the end zone, but Sterneman. As the teams up the field for the halftime break, the Bears held a 12-0 lead. Giants fans were blue because their team trailed, and the thousands of other fans were disappointed because the great Red Grange had not been allowed to show off his talents. Grange even sat out the entire third quarter. The Giants scored a touchdown and added an extra point. Now it was 12-7 in favor of the Bears. A chorus of chants, "We want Grange," echoed through the park as the final period got underway. And seconds later, Grange joined his teammates in the huddle. A whole quarter remained for Red to show the crowd his amazing talent. I'll be back in a minute. The Giants took the air. Seconds ticked off. One pass, then another. They were on the move. Still another, but this time Grange picked it out of the air. An interception. The crowd held its breath. He sidestepped one Giant player, then another. Grange headed for the sideline. He was almost clear. Just one more player to get past. Into the end zone he scooted for a touchdown. Reg Grange had not disappointed the thousands of fans who had come to see him play. They had seen the greatest player of his time, and maybe the greatest ever.